Powell v. State. Are you ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you.
Very well.
Good morning. May it please the Court, Nicole Walker, along with co-counsel Santino Saccotti, on behalf of the appellant, Derek Powell. I will address issues related to Mr. Powell's death sentence, and if time permits, Mr. Saccotti will address trial issues. The death sentence in this case amounts to cruel and unusual punishment in violation of the United States Constitution because the evidence is insufficient to establish the requisite culpability, and the sentence is disproportional to the other similar cases within the relevant universe of cases to which it must be compared. In this case, the state indicted Mr. Powell on two murder charges. Count one was recklessly causing the death of a law enforcement officer. Count three was recklessly causing the death of an individual during a flight from attempted robbery. They also charged him with assault of the other officer that was in the car who was injured by the same bullet that killed Officer Spicer. They also charged him with resisting arrest and, of course, all the attempted robbery-related offenses. The jury acquitted Mr. Powell of the first count of recklessly causing the death of a law enforcement officer. However, and they acquitted him of the assault. However, they convicted him of the assault, of the recklessly causing the death during the flight from the robbery and resisting arrest. After he was convicted, the jury returned after the penalty phase an underwhelming recommendation of 7-5 for death, and the court subsequently imposed the death sentence. When a defendant is convicted of felony murder, and there are multiple defendants, and it is not clear who is the actual shooter, this court must conduct an analysis under Edmund versus Florida.
Well, you say it's not clear, but we have a factual finding by the trial judge at the penalty phase that your client actually caused the death of the officer?
Yes, Your Honor. The trial court imposed its own findings, filled in the gaps of what the verdict actually tells us, which does not give us much information. The court's decision was based almost entirely on the testimony of Luis Flores, who, by the way, was just as culpable under accomplice liability of felony murder, but was charged with absolutely nothing. And he was the only one that identified our client as the shooter, the actual shooter. And in order to establish the proof Edmund and Tyson, the state has to show that there was a major participant in the underlying felony, as well as a reckless indifference to human life. And they did not establish that in this case.
Well, the judge found that, though.
The judge found that based almost entirely on Mr. Flores' testimony. We're not disputing that those findings support a conviction, if those findings are correct, of the felony murder in this case. We are in a different area now. We are talking about the death of an individual, of our client, which is cruel and unusual punishment in this case. Therefore, the court should have exercised even more caution when relying on Mr. Flores' testimony.
Well, the court didn't only rely on his testimony. In the sentencing report, it talked about the fact that after the shots were fired, if Flores really was the shooter, he would have had to hand the gun to Powell, and Powell would have had to have fled with the gun, notwithstanding the fact he knew that Flores had just shot a police officer, mm-hmm. and there would have been more exchanges in the car after they left McDonald's and the shots were fired. And the judge made a factual finding based on all of those facts that the defense theory was illogical, mm-hmm. didn't he?
He did make that conclusion. However, as I stated, he filled in gaps of what the jury's verdict lets us know. Now,
wasn't there a specific conviction for resisting arrest with force or violence?
Yes.
That was specifically premised on Powell being the shooter?
Yes, well...
And didn't the jury find him guilty on that?
They found him guilty of the resisting arrest, which does involve intent and shooting a weapon. Now, if the court relies on that, which it did, he's essentially imposing a death sentence based on the culpability of a resisting arrest. For whatever reason, and the court noted it did not understand the reason why the jury acquitted him of the first reckless murder. And he goes on to opine what it was that they possibly could have meant. The court can't impose a death sentence upon someone by divining what the verdict may possibly have meant. In this case, the circumstantial evidence, in addition to what Your Honor mentioned, points to either one of them as the shooters. They both had...
Ms. Walker, I'm having difficulty with your constitutional argument, or at least the facts on which it's premised. Is it critical to your constitutional argument that we reject a jury's apparent finding that your client was the shooter?
No, and here's why. The state points to the fact that there was no accomplice liability.
It doesn't matter why. That was the finding. So
this was the finding.
He was a shooter.
Mm-hmm.
You're saying even so, it would be a violation of his constitutional rights.
What I'm saying is that those findings were erroneous on his part because he based it on the verdict of the jury, which is not clear. And even though he opined that perhaps they didn't find him guilty.
I don't know what you mean by not clear.
Okay. Let me explain. What happened was they acquitted him of what one would think is obvious, that the Officer Spicer was a law enforcement officer, and convicted him of fleeing, of shooting during the flight, and intentionally convicted him of resisting arrest. The court opined, well, maybe they decided that Officer Spicer was acting passively, and that's why they acquitted him. Or maybe they thought he shouldn't have, couldn't be convicted of two offenses.
Okay, well, let's clear that underbrush aside. Let's assume that the jury clearly, based on the record, found that he was the shooter.
Okay.
Now, on that premise, how does your constitutional argument fare?
Well, it is cruel and unusual because it's disproportionate not only to other cases, but also it's incongruent with what happened to his accomplices in this case. And that is, if the court determines that Mr. Powell did actually do the shooting, we have circumstances that would at least appear to be incongruous with the consequences of the others involved.
So let's assume that the state prosecuted Flores as well, and he was convicted, supposedly as an accomplice, and either got the death penalty or, a life sentence. Would that change your argument?
Yes, if it take away from the argument, it wouldn't make it completely different. There would be what we have here.
Well, would it take it away enough that it would no longer rise to the
constitutional because
level?
The case is also disproportionate to Mr. Reeves' charges and also disproportionate to other similar cases. For example, Mr. Powell did not set up the robbery. It was Flores and Reeves. It was sudden and impulsive. The court determined that it wasn't based on the culpability of the attempted robbery, which in Edmund and State versus Rodriguez says you can't impose a death penalty based on culpability of the other offenses. However, Mr. Flores planned the robbery. It was his car that was used. He had the gunshot phone number on him, as well as the names of the bullets that were used. He was a major contributor to the DNA on the trigger. He had another robbery planned, yet he was not even charged with anything. Now, if we had a situation where perhaps he even got charged with attempted robbery or convicted of that and received 20 or 30 years, we would be closer to a more reasonable sentence in this case. But he got nothing, and yet he was allowed to testify against our client.
So the disproportionality argument is basically predicated on a comparison between this case and other cases where there were 7-5 jury votes.
That's correct.
Plus the non-case against Mr. Flores.
Yes, plus the non-accountability of Mr. Flores. Three individuals equally culpable of felony murder under an accomplice liability standard. One gets absolutely nothing. The other gets time served plus 6 months of boot camp.
Okay, and if you were to, and I'll stop it, if you were to distill that argument to a rule of law, which would be necessary if this court were to rule in your client's favor, what would that rule be?
Well, the rule would be that it's incongruous with his co-defendants. The court, State versus Rodriguez and other courts in the state, it's not a novel idea to compare what he receives to that what his accomplices receive. In fact, that's what the whole Edmund Tyson theory is based on. And so
Would your argument stand if we took out of the picture the other 7 to 5 jury votes and just focused on Mr. Flores?
Yes. If the court were to look at all cases within the universe of cases to which it must be compared, it's still disproportionate. The other cases, and even the 7 to 5 ones, which would cut more, it would be more similar, involve cases where there was brutal killings, and there were also, for example, the other 7 to 5 cases, which are within the universe, involve, out of the 8 that have been imposed, and as the 8 that rendered a 7 to 5 verdict and the 2 that were imposed involved situations where the defendants invaded the sanctity of a victim's home, killed multiple victims, burned or abused the victim's corpse in a horrific manner, killed in a manner that was gruesome, vicious, or brutal, killed the victim in front of his family, planned to kill someone, intended to kill someone. And in this case, Mr. Powell was not even indicted and convicted of intentional murder.
Help me understand your definition of what the universe of cases is for purposes of comparison. Is it just the 7 to 5 cases?
No, it is not. It involves the cases involving, similar to the current case that went to penalty hearing, resulted in either a life or death sentence. These cases are actually are lesser standard than the other cases. The other cases involve significantly more votes for death. And those cases also, none of them come close to this situation where those cases also involve intentional murder.
In this particular case, the state points out it's the first time a law enforcement officer was killed in the line of duty. And in its answering brief, gives a fairly articulate quote from the North Carolina court about the significance of undermining our civilized society and confidence in the rule of law. Now, I don't think you filed a reply brief in this case.
We did.
So my question is, whether you did or you didn't, how do you respond to the uniqueness argument with regard to killing a police officer in the line of duty when we're looking at this in the universe of cases?
Certainly. First of all, the jury was not permitted to consider that he was a law enforcement officer as an aggravating circumstance because they acquitted him of that. That being said, North Carolina also found a killing of a police officer to be disproportionate in State versus Hill, stating that the killing in this case of a police officer, though as all murders, senseless, was not especially heinous, atrocious, or cruel. And in that case, it involved a chase, a pursuit, and the individual, again, intentionally killed the police officer. So, and if the court were to look at all the other cases cited by the state, they involve situations where defendant hit a brandy bottle over the police officer's head, struggled with him, stole his weapon, and when the police officer was begging for his life, shot him. It involves situations where he elbowed the officer, learned that he had a bulletproof vest on, so he knew he had to shoot him in the head to kill him. These are the types of cases that the state cites, intentional murders that are more gruesome than what we have here.
So are you saying that in anything other than an intentional murder, it's not permissible to give capital punishment? Because let me say succinctly what I understand to be the position the trial judge took based on the evidence of your client's involvement, that Officer Spicer was not the only person he shot at that day. That he used his weapon during the commission of the felony, was actually shooting at a person down on the ground. In between the time he shot at the victim of the felony and the time of the shooting, Officer Spicer, there's testimony that he voiced the view that if the police stopped him, he was gonna fire again.
Mm-hmm.
That he intentionally discharged his weapon at Officer Spicer, and you're saying that it's disproportionate. Why? I'm struggling with that because there's a pattern of use of a deadly weapon. Is what you're saying that if someone just frankly kills in a fairly clean way with a handgun because it's not brutal chopping or something like that, that it can't be death penalty eligible?
No, what I'm saying is compared to the cases that have been decided that are within the universe of cases, this does not rise to those levels.
But it's like, how do we deal with the fact that new cases arise? I mean, in the proportionality analysis.
Okay, well, it is to be compared to the other cases that have come before it. And the court,
if someone shot intentionally at two human beings in one close period of time, and in between the two shootings expressed the view that he was going to shoot again, why is that type of behavior not death penalty eligible?
It's not death penalty eligible in this case because, for whatever reason, the jury acquitted him of killing a law enforcement officer. They convicted him of reckless, whether the resisting arrest or any other crime was intentional, the murder was reckless. If the court were to convict him based on his mens rea of the other crimes, then it is as if we're raising a resisting arrest to a penalty of the death sentence.
Well, why isn't this case like Laurie versus State? Now, Mr. Laurie was acquitted of the intentional killing of his wife, but was convicted of the reckless killing of his children, and he was sentenced to death, and this court found that to be proportional.
Well, in that case, Mr. Laurie actually deliberately set fire to the home with his children and other children in it, as well as the wife. That clearly, again, rises to a more heinous crime than what we have here. Yes, the trial court made findings, but the trial court cannot fill in the gaps to define what it was that the jury meant by its verdict. And that's what it did. It and the state seemed to urge that this was an intentional killing.
Okay, then doesn't it follow that under your theory of disproportionality, it would be a cruel and unusual punishment to impose death as the penalty for a conviction of reckless homicide or reckless killing?
No.
But the only distinguishing factor is the premeditated intent. And you're saying, regardless of what the court may have found in the sentencing phase, the jury acquitted this defendant of intentional homicide.
No, he was not even charged with intentional.
He wasn't charged with intentional.
What I would say is, no, that's not the only factor. It's reckless and a 7-5 vote for death. 42%, if they represent the community, 42% of the community said, don't kill this man.
All right. So if the jury had voted 11-1 instead of 7-5, would that matter?
It would make a difference. It is a factor to consider within...
Well, would it make a critical difference?
Certainly.
The case would turn on that.
I don't know that the case would completely turn on it because the court is not required to give great weight to the verdict, the recommendation. But if the court looks at all the other cases that the state cited, we're dealing with 12-0 votes, 9-3 votes. And in Barrow versus State, the court looked to an 8-4 vote and said that was that one-third of the people there said don't kill him, and that factored significantly in its decision.
And Ms. Walker, you've used almost all of the time you've reserved. Would you like to save the remaining time?
Yes, actually, the remaining time is set aside for Mr. Sicotti. I believe that we have 5 minutes set aside for him to address the trial issues.
Very well.
Thank you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
May it please the court, Santino Chakotay on behalf of the appellant Derek Powell. I'll be addressing the three issues in our papers to this court involving the trial and guilt phase of the case. Unless the court would like to hear a particular issue, I'd like to begin on the lesser included offense that was denied by the trial court below. Mr. Powell failed to receive the full benefit of the reasonable doubt standard when the court refused to provide the jury the third option as to murder second degree. That was to count three, which he was ultimately convicted of. as charged, the difference that we're dealing with is a requisite mens rea of either reckless or criminally negligent conduct. The Superior Court denied the request, and they cited the Capano decision from this court and concluded that essentially Powell pointed the loaded gun and therefore cannot be negligent. The court below went badly astray, not only in relying on Capano, but also by failing to do an independent review of the record, which, the issue being de novo, this court has the authority to do that. An independent review of the record in this case reveals that Powell may not have even pointed or fired the weapon, but he may have just had the weapon on his lap as it discharged when there was a collision at the end of the police chase. The testimony of Flores indicates that the gunshot and the car crash occurred simultaneously. This was also the testimony of Officer Brittingham, and Reeves also testified that the police chase ended abruptly when the gunshot fired. More importantly in the record is the testimony of the state's forensic firearms expert, Carl Roan. Carl Roan testified that he could not ascertain the angle that the projectile discharged from the weapon and hit the officer's vehicle.
Can you help me understand the argument that's being made from a perspective of how it could have even occurred? If the gun was on his lap, wouldn't the bullet go through the door and not the window?
Well, Your Honor, that's precisely the gap or the hole in the record that Carl Roan testified to. There was no angle that could be determined from the testimony of the state's expert as to how that bullet penetrated the windshield and entered the car of the police cruiser. In fact, we did provide, I believe, a digital image in our exhibits to this court, in our papers, where we can see that, if you credit Flores' testimony, he says that Powell stuck his arm outside of the window and fired the shot. That the windshield is shattered, and Mr. Roan testified that the shot came 12 inches from the windshield. So the gun was fired from inside of the car, or was discharged inside of the car. And what defense counsel asked the court to do is simply allow the jury to decide. Remember, as Ms. Walker indicated, the state chose not to indict with intentional murder. The jury was dealing with the reckless conduct of Mr. Powell. To simply ask that the jury consider whether Powell might have failed to perceive a risk by holding the weapon during a police chase and possibly have the mens rea of criminal negligence is something the jury should have been able to consider. That's what an independent review of the record reveals that. Now, the Superior Court cites Capano, which could not be further from this case than possible. In Capano, you had non-existent evidence which the jury was not free to infer. There was no murder weapon. The victim's body was never recovered. And in fact, the defendant in Capano was using an accident defense.
I understand the Capano. I'm trying to get Justice Ridgely's answer. I'm trying to figure out your primary defense or primary argument was that Flores was the shooter, not Powell.
Correct.
In which case, that's not, whatever that is, that's not consistent with an accident. It's not consistent with criminal negligence on the part of Powell. And then your other theory is that Powell had the weapon under his shirt on his lap. And that when the vehicle struck, the weapon accidentally discharged and produced this hole in the digital image, which seems to be right adjacent to the seat at the top part of the window.
Correct.
I mean, stuff happens, right? There are people who believe there were landings in the southwest of the United States by extraterrestrial creatures. There has to be something, though, for a trial judge to sustain in the record that's a non-speculative basis in evidence that this occurred. And your primary theory is inconsistent with it. Your other theory was based on it's under his shirt, right? And it goes off when the collision occurs. His shirt doesn't have a hole blown in it. Is there any testimony that supports that it could have happened this way?
Well, I see my time is expired. I'd like to answer the Chancellor's,
question.
Okay. Certainly, it's an alternative theory of what occurred. We understand that in our papers and the defense at trial is we think Flores was the shooter. Alternatively, at the very least, there's evidence in the record. And to answer your question more specifically, what do we have? We have Flores saying that Powell held the gun on his lap. We have Officer Brittingham and Flores indicating that the crash occurred literally simultaneously to the gunfire. So it wasn't a stop and time to pull out, lean over the car windshield, and fire the shot. There's enough in this record for a jury to at least consider whether Powell was reckless in his conduct or negligent in his conduct.
Thank you very much.
May it please the court, Justice Holland, Justices Chancellor. Good morning, Paul Wallace on behalf of the appellee of the state of Delaware in this matter.
Good morning.
Mr. Powell does three things. One, he tries to avoid what is the true proportionality analysis that this court must do by trying to cabinet into only cases that involve certain votes. We know that our death penalty statute doesn't work that way, nor does the proportionality review that this court does. The second thing he tries to do is he tries to avoid or tries to apply the accomplice death penalty case law to a non-accomplice case where he was, in fact, the principal. And the last thing he tries to do, both in his death penalty arguments and in his trial arguments that we just heard, is argue facts that simply don't make any sense. Alternative arguments are fine, and you may make them as an attorney. You may try to weave together whatever you possibly can on behalf of your client. But that does not require a court to then say, well, there obviously is a rational basis. The court must determine whether there is a rational basis in the evidence, for instance, before it gives a lesser included offense. And here the court said there was not.
Can I interrupt you for a second? Opposing counsel suggests that the sentence was disproportional in part because the other people involved in these crimes did not receive, well, one of them received nothing as a sentence and or wasn't charged. What is your response to that? We have one person out of a group of culpable criminals who is facing the death penalty and others who are facing no penalty.
Well, Your Honor, I think that that might, the other culpability that is found of other participants might make a difference if, in fact, you didn't have the most culpable one facing the death penalty. What I'm saying is if Mr. Flores, for instance, let's assume the facts as all of us believe them to be and as common sense tells us. Mr. Flores, he was in for the robbery, no doubt. He probably was not in for the Derek Powell taking a shot at the robbery victim, and in fact, they got out of there, and in fact, Flores and Reeves were both very, from what the facts tell us, very upset by that, and certainly wasn't in for the shooting of the police officer.
But doesn't the record reflect that at McDonald's it was Flores who said to Reeves, wait for Powell?
Don't leave him.
Don't leave him.
And that, as opposed to being, gosh, I'm fine with him shooting him, may B, what happens when somebody does something unexpectedly that way. But what is clear is when Officer Brittingham gets shot, Flores goes to his aid. He had nothing to do and wanted nothing to do with that shooting and immediately discusses with the police exactly what happened and what his part was. He wants to make it right. And so if, in fact, Mr. Flores was the one here with the death sentence, and we believe those all to be the facts, and Powell was never charged, the principal, the person who actually shot him, the person who said, yeah, if you pull over, I'm taking a shot at the cops, who had on previous occasions said that he would take care of police. If that was the case, then yes, Your Honor, the relative culpability of the participants might say something to the proportionality of Mr. Flores's death sentence. Not here.
Yeah,
here we have.
Let me make sure I understand this, because that was a very lengthy factual response to a legal question. You're saying that there might be something to the argument if Mr. Flores was charged as an accomplice and there were a basis, in fact, for him to be convicted as an accomplice. Is that correct so far?
Yes.
The argument then goes on as follows. There was no basis, in fact, to charge him. At most, he was an accomplice up to the point of the shooting, but not thereafter.
No, I'm sorry, Your Honor. If I confused the second part of this analysis, that's my fault by giving too long of an answer. Let's assume for this case that Mr. Flores could have been charged as an accomplice. Let's assume that he was. Let's assume that he was the only one charged, and he went to trial. Under the facts as we know them, the facts being that he just sat there, didn't actively shoot, things like that. If he was the one facing a death sentence here, then yes, perhaps the relative culpability of the participants in that crime would say something to whether or not Mr. Flores's death sentence was proportional. That's not what this case is, though. So what I'm saying is, yes, there are cases, and there could be factual circumstances, where the relative culpability of the participants is something you take into consideration as to whether or not the person who ultimately got the death sentence, that sentence is proportionate. In my scenario, for instance, if we had Mr. Flores here. But that's not this case. We don't have to worry about that, because what we have is the shooter. And when you have the shooter, what the other lesser players got doesn't matter in the proportionality review.
Why
not
is
in
that?
This factual circumstance.
Well, you know, I understand you're saying that it would be significant, or you're conceding that it might be significant if the person who was only an accomplice and did not actually pull the trigger got the death penalty, and by comparison, the person who pulled the trigger, who was the most culpable, did not get the death penalty. But here we've got arguably the most culpable defendant getting the death penalty, but you've got other participants walking away. Isn't that disproportional, even taking into account the fact that the other participants arguably were somewhat less culpable?
Your Honor, respectfully, I think they're far less culpable. Every day there has to be decisions made when multiple people play a part in a crime. And what appeared clear here was that, for instance, Flores and Reeves may be in for robbing a drug dealer. But it didn't appear they were in for robbing a drug dealer and shooting at him, and then eventually shooting at the police when they flee. And their actions said quite the opposite. And so, in trying to determine what was proper with them, they were charged or not charged as they were. But that says nothing to the proportionality of the ultimate shooter's death sentence, not under these factual circumstances. And again, I'm not saying that there's never going to be some analysis that one does as to what relative roles people have and what they do in a crime. But it's not a concern in this case, and it's certainly not the overriding concern that Mr. Powell seems to make. I mean, no doubt, he wants to lay this at Flores' feet and say, and he got away with it, and I should too. I mean, that, if I was to sum up his argument, that would be it. The facts are quite different, and the trial judge found those facts, the jury found those facts, it's all those facts, and the state suggests that that argument in his proportionality makes little sense. His sentence is proportionate, however, And his sentence is...
Okay, so you're saying, number one, we can disregard what happened or didn't happen to Mr. Flores in the disproportionality analysis. That leaves one other element, however, and that's the cases that were 7-5, you know, with the jury voted 7-5. What's the legal argument that that is insufficient to establish disproportionality?
Well, Your Honor, I think, first of all, in Manley, that defendant, when it was 9-3, tried to cabin the universe of cases to just 9-3 cases, and this court rejected that. The vote, as we know, is
If we did cabin the universe to those cases, is there a response to the argument
that
on,
this
on
is
its merits?
Disproportionate to the 7-5? No, because I think there are unique factors. Each and every death sentence has to rise or fall on its individual facts. The shooting of a police officer, the killing of a police officer under these circumstances, for the purposes of ensuring that you can get away with just trying to have robbed a drug dealer and kill him, there is something qualitatively different about that in this regard. The other aspects that you would have to look at is that a death sentence doesn't just go to the nature and circumstances of the crime itself. What they want to throw away is his character and propensities. You weigh the whole thing. You look at his character and propensities, as the trial judge did here, as the state had, in fact, set forth in its statutory aggravators, and that he argued in his statutory, in his non-statutory mitigators, I'm sorry, and the non-statutory aggravators, the totality. When you look at the entire picture, the court had determined that the death sentence was appropriate. The vote is just one aspect, and we know that the court has the discretion to give it what weight it wishes to give.
Well, under your approach, and I'm not saying it's wrong, but the result is to atomize these comparisons into a number of colliding particles. Wouldn't that make the disproportionality analysis impossible as a practical matter?
I don't think that it's impossible, Your Honor, but I think that, as this court has said, look, you can't find direct symmetry. So what you try to look for are the trends, to a certain extent. What is it that our society finds to be more appropriate for the ultimate punishment? What are the things either in the crime itself or among the character and propensities of these offenders that does that? And the state attempted to put
this... You go from the atomic level up to 30,000 feet, and what are you looking for?
Well, I think what you are looking for, like I said, I think you're looking for similarities in the cases. If the only similarity is the vote, well, then we may as well just go back to the jury being the ultimate sentence.
Basically, we should be looking at police killing cases.
We can look at police killing cases. That could be one. Unfortunately, I shouldn't say unfortunately. Fortunately, in Delaware, we don't have those to compare. So the state tried to lay out the fact that it is treated more seriously in other jurisdictions that have had to deal with that, and that's a very telling, aggravating circumstance in this case. The other things that you look at, for instance, as the state has laid out, what's the criminal history of this person? Because that makes a big difference to sentencers. When one has had time and time again had opportunities and has set those apart, and what has their criminal record shown, as the court found in this case, as the Superior Court found in this case, he's a self-centered, violent person who had said before, in other criminal aspects, I'll take care of the cops. He was a cop killer waiting to happen. And he did. And for this individual, the death sentence became appropriate, given all the facts and circumstances. this is a unique set of circumstances that this court has seen. And as we wrote our proportionality review, it did become difficult because you do look for what you find most often. Thankfully, this was a unique circumstance. Thankfully, we do not have police officers killed in the line of duty in this way. Unfortunately, what we came across was a person who was self-centered, who was violent, and who had made a decision that I'm not going in peacefully. The jury found that when it found him guilty of resisting arrest by violence and found, in fact, that he did so by shooting at the police officers. And gave their verdict, the trial judge, and one of the reasons I suggest there is a wisdom to the trial judges doing the ultimate sentencing, is the trial judge can lay this case up against the universe of cases that he or she sees in sentencing people day in and day out, and noted that Derek Powell was unique. He was a cop killer. He did that, and for that reason, plus all of the other facts and circumstances, he rendered a death verdict. If there are no other questions on the other issues, the state has no further argument on this one.
Thank you. Now, you have a minute and a half left, and that's the total left for both arguments, so you can use it however you wish.
We're going to address the death penalty issue. One of the things about the incongruence penalties of the three individuals that must be focused on and why it's so important is that the United States Supreme Court has said that a death sentence, the purpose of that is deterrence and retribution. Certainly those purposes are not served if out of three people, one is sentenced to death and the others get off scot-free. We're not saying that if the court finds that he was the shooter, that he should be let free. We're not saying that he was not culpable at all. We're saying that within the universe of cases, whatever cases the court wants to use, whether they're 7-5 votes, 9-3 votes, etc., he got death when his co-defendants got nothing. And that is a significant factor when considering the purposes of the death penalty.
Let's test that. Suppose, hypothetically, that the state agreed, at the prosecuting stage, agreed with your concern that it wasn't totally clear who the shooter was. And so both Flores and Powell are indicted and brought to trial on these charges. And presumably, each of them pointed the finger at the other, and the jury weighed the evidence and found that Powell was the shooter and acquitted Mr. Flores. Would that affect your argument?
Certainly it would. That one of the things that gets lost in this when we get told that they were less culpable, it's clear they were culpable at least of the attempted robbery and got nothing there.
I mean, but in my hypothetical, as here, the bottom line is that Mr. Flores gets off.
Right.
And would that make the death sentence for Mr. Powell disproportionate?
May I answer your Honor's question? I'm out of time. It would not make a proportion, if I understand your question correctly, it would not affect, it would affect the actual analysis, but it would not turn completely on that. It would, in fact, affect, what I'm saying is, if Mr. Flores had gotten 30 years or life, it would make more sense for Mr. Powell to get the death sentence, and that's how it factors in.
Well, just tell me how your perception of proportionality works internally and externally. We're focusing here on internally what happened to all of the people who participated in the crime. Mm-hmm. But isn't the traditional focus of our court external on similarly situated defendants and other circumstances who have been death penalty eligible in the past and either did or did not get the death sentence?
That is the mandatory proportionality review. However, the court needs to look, as Mr. Wallace stated, to all the unique circumstances of the actual incident. And one of the main unique circumstances is that the two co-defendants who put Mr. Powell up to the attempted robbery and created this situation were not punished at all.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And thank you all for your arguments. The court will take this matter under advisement. We'll also take a brief recess. Please rise.